Mark said that he would warn everybody that they have to not skip my play. I'm going to have an allergy attack. I just feel it coming. Do you have one of your meetings tomorrow, Chris?
You do.
Okay. I don't want to come to school at 12. Thanks anyway. It's so cold in that slide room. I just try to work as much as I can at home. So where is... I don't understand where Frank Lloyd Wright went. Oh, here. Okay. Frank Lloyd Wright, 15 and 16. Is the giving of awards over in the gallery? Did you just come from the gallery?
Yeah. I didn't start a thing about
it. Huh?
Yeah, it's already.
Mark said that they'd start at 4:30 and be over by 10 after 5. Okay. They haven't even. Okay, so I don't know. I can't wait then. Nothing I can do. So you know how I'm always delighted when something that I have taught you appears in a major newspaper or something, you know, like it's called literacy, right? So Sunday New York Times, and I open up the art section, and here, I mean, this is just incredible. The Diego Rivera mural cycle, right, that I just taught you. This is an artist, Julie Moretu, who was commissioned by the Detroit Institute of the Arts to do a new cycle of paintings because they rehabbed. I want to just read it to you, okay? The flux in Detroit's fortunes over the last century is strikingly mirrored in its world-class Beaux-Arts-style museum built in the 1920s by a cultural elite flush with money and eager for a grandly scale downtown district. So that's the building that we studied, right? Much of that wealth, of course, sprang from the automobile industry. The history of this industry is embedded in Diego Rivera's renowned frescoes, Detroit Industry, 1932-33, at the Detroit Institute of Arts. Okay? What was harmonious in the murals, laborers of all races working in unison for the good of industry, was far less so in reality. And over time, the racial tensions in Detroit, climaxing in the riots of 67, profoundly altered the urban landscape. Detroit has never fully recovered, which is true. even though, isn't that where they built the rock and roll? No, that's Cleveland. For the artist Julie Moreccio, who grew up largely in East Lansing, Michigan, the Detroit Institute of Arts and other vintage downtown landmarks have the cast of magnificent relics. Today, the Institute is in the process of unerasing itself. On November 23rd, next week, I guess, it is to reopen to the public after a $158 million expansion by the architect Michael Graves. So if you don't know Michael Graves, Google him. He's a fabulous contemporary architect. So they've completely rehabbed the museum. Curators are reinstalling the museum's exhibition space, etc., etc. And Moreccio was commissioned to do a cycle of paintings, which are these top ones. Can you see it from the back at all? Right? They're cityscapes and highwayscapes, but they're abstractions. So it's a counter, you know, to the Diego Rivera, which has been fully cleaned, et cetera, et cetera. But I just thought it was so timely to sort of have this in the paper on Sunday, right after I had taught you about it. And I would have loved to bring in Julie Moreccio, whose work I know, but of course, there are no images in the collection here. Nobody does really, if you ask me, contemporary art here. So my little 2 cents. So today we're going to do Frank Lloyd Wright and then the Maya Revival style, page 15-16 in your study guide. How many of you live or drive through the freeway on Marin County with any regularity? 1, 2, 3. So what do you always see that Frank Lloyd Wright did? Back of the room? What? I think... Yeah. And what do you call it? It's the county building for Marin County. It's that blue structure. If you're going north, it's on the right-hand side of the freeway. Ring a bell, anybody? It's really close, and it's a huge Frank Lloyd Wright project that he did. And I just was wondering if you were aware of the fact. And then there's something else downtown. Does anybody know what else downtown Frank Lloyd Wright did?
The brick facade.
What?
That brick facade.
Yeah, the brick facade building. Do you know what street it's on? Do you remember? Yeah. It's a fabulous building. Next time you're downtown, please go. It is on Maiden Lane. And it's had reincarnations. It's a store. I don't know how else to explain it. There's many different stores that have moved in and out. But when you walk, it's got a brick. It's quintessential Frank Lloyd Wright. And it's sort of like the Guggenheim Museum in New York. It's got a ramp that goes up. And it's got a brick facade. And it's absolutely just a gem. So those are two Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, you know, sort of right here where we live. And there are others close by, and you'll see some other. I did one famous local building for this lecture also. So Frank Lloyd Wright, considered the pioneer American, meaning North American, architect, 1869 to 1959. F-E-F-G. Okay. I had my, my little wheel that spins around when you go to something, right? My wheel kept spinning and spinning and spinning for 15 minutes and five. Just thought this lecture was going to be ruined, but I don't think it was.
The rainbow wheel of death.
Is that what you call it? Yeah. Oh, God, and you'd have to take out the battery to make it to stop spinning. Okay, so, in about 1887, I'm sorry, I keep going backwards, I know. In 1887, Frank Lloyd Wright began to work for the Chicago architect Louis Sullivan. Sullivan was creating very innovative buildings, office buildings, and which were tall to accommodate downtown commercial and office space in Chicago. So Louis Sullivan is considered one of the pioneers of the high-rise, the American high-rise. And Frank Lloyd Wright is a very young architect, got a job in Louis Sullivan's office. Sullivan was also famous for his use of ornament. He was inspired by what is always considered exotic sources and vegetation and flowers, and his buildings are quite ornamental on the exterior. So this was the environment, in the architectural environment, that Frank Lloyd Wright sort of entered into at Louis Sullivan's office. And then I know you already have guessed what happened, right? Just by looking up at the screen or down at your study guide. Frank Lloyd Wright encountered pre-Hispanic architecture through a very circuitous route. Now, I don't want you to have to write down many of these names, so just listen for a moment. He first encountered it in a library context. And there's a very famous French architectural theorist named Viollet-le-Duc, and you can't study the history of architecture without knowing about Viollet-le-Duc and his treatises on architecture. And Viollet-le-Duc worked with a man named Désiré Charnay, and they wrote Ancient Cities of the New World. So Frank Lloyd Wright first discovers the pre-Hispanic architecture in a library context in Chicago from these two great architectural theoreticians and scholars who amass a collection of drawings of ancient sites in the Americas. Okay? That was their goal, to this collection of ancient American sites. And it was based on a trip, and you do have to know Charnay's name, but here it is on page 15, that Charnay took to Mexico and Central America from 1857 to 1860. He's French, and I think you know, or maybe you know, that Napoleon was in charge in Mexico for a while. You've had a decent history course, right? And it was under Napoleon's sort of commission that this French architect started looking at all these pre-Hispanic sites and documenting them. So it was very, very early on that this happened. Wright also knew two other books, very famous books, Incidents of Travels in the Yucatan. So just without even knowing these people's names, he had this hunger to find out about pre-Hispanic architecture. He was beginning to evolve into what we call an Americanist. He was not looking toward a European Beaux-Arts style for inspiration, okay? So in 1893, he visited the Chicago World's Fair. So this fair comes up a lot, and it's a very important fair. The one that just right was shipped out to San Francisco afterwards, if you remember the first part of the course. And anybody who visited that fair from any number of points of view was enormously influenced by it. So he has documented the fact that he spent lunch hours and lunch hours and lunch hours walking through the Chicago World's Fair. And then Sullivan, the architecture firm he worked with, got a commission to design the transportation building at the fair. So Frank Lloyd Wright was brought in to work on that particular building at the fair also. The exterior of the Anthropology building at the fair were plaster casts of Yucatan buildings. We're going to see them again. You saw them when I did my lecture. And inside the Anthropology building at the fair was a collection of Maya artifacts and 162 photographs of Maya architecture. Okay? After the exposition, the World's Fair, all of this material went to the Field Museum in Chicago, which is the Natural History Museum in Chicago. So right away, you see that this was the foundation, right, of a change of style and how Frank Lloyd Wright begins to mature into his own style as an architect. So I just want to briefly tell me if the light's okay in the back. No matter how many times I've asked for that bulb to be changed, they won't change it.
Are you okay back there? Yeah? Okay. So, what I started out with, just so sort of for you to see it a little bit, were some sort of introductory slides to this whole lecture today. So this man is an American anthropologist. His name is Alfred Maudsley, and he was at Chichen Itza in the Yucatan and published a book, and all these photographs were taken in 1889. So it's part of this huge interest in pre-Hispanic architecture at the end of the 1800s. And then just, this is totally not legible. But anyway, what we're going to be mostly concerned with is Maya architecture of the Yucatan Peninsula. This is the Yucatan Peninsula. Cuba is right here. Okay? Havana is right there. So you know that this is where the lot of Mayan buildings are. You've already learned about Uxmal, and you'll learn about it again. And then is this legible? Yes, good. So here we have the Yucatan Peninsula. Look up at the top of the map. You see Yucatan, and then you see the three or four sites up there. So those are the sites that really began to be publicized a lot and had a lot of influence on Frank Lloyd Wright. Then you have a series of buildings, mostly on the West Coast, that also show an appreciation of Mayan architecture. So this, for example, I'm scooting around the dates a little bit. This is the Southwest Museum in Los Angeles, the original museum of the history of the Southwest in Los Angeles. It's located very near Eagle Rock, which is between downtown and Pasadena. And here is the entrance to it. So the entrance to this museum is based on really a... isn't that interesting? This morning at work... Oh, because it's white. But anyway, it's based on an appreciation of architecture of the Mayans. This whole sort of... And it sort of demonstrates the kind of influence Mayan architecture had on the West Coast. So this is 1919-1920. Then we see this is the only photograph I could find. There was a big exposition in 1935 in San Diego. And here you have the major building, right, the federal building that was built for this exposition. You've seen this many times before, right? This is the famous pointed arch from Uxmal. I'll show you it again in the Yucatan. And then you have the idea of a facade that is made up of cut stone that imitates the facade of buildings in the Yucatan. So this is 1935. This is the Brooklyn Museum in New York City. Can you see it? No. But in 1935, they had a huge Mayan show, and they built little models of Mayan architecture. So really what I'm trying to do is set you up for the lecture today, that by the end of the 1800s into the 1930s, there was just this sort of Mayan craze that swept across the United States. This is what Frank Lloyd Wright's earliest private commissions look like. They are not influenced by Mayan architecture. They are the name of this style of architecture is called the Prairie Style. These buildings were first built in Illinois in areas outside of Chicago, and these are private homes. So this is 1890 to 94 that Frank Lloyd Wright did this house. This is the William Winslow House. And here you have two more of his houses, William Winslow House from the back view and the side view. And this is called the Prairie Style. So what you get are the large overhanging roof elements. Do you see this? And then the very rectangular, long, and horizontal emphasis on these houses. All over the San Francisco Bay Area, there is a style of house that is based on this style. One of the quintessential places to see it is Piedmont, California, right across the Bay Bridge. And here they call it the Prairie Style or the Arts and Crafts Style. So this is the style of architecture that Frank Lloyd Wright started doing early in his career when he started getting these sort of early commissions. Then he did a rather fabulous early commission in Tokyo. Unfortunately, this building burned to the ground, so we only know it in the big Tokyo earthquake. But this is the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo. Can you see there's a remnant of this horizontal emphasis that I was showing you in the private houses, but it is really different. And all, I'm going to have to use this bloody arrow here, and I wrote myself a note this big to go to Radio Shack, so by Thursday I'll have a new battery. So you have all this ornament here. You have this type of ornamental sort of structural support there. You've got the ornament up here. You've got it right here, and you see the different levels of horizontal emphasis are sort of cut into by this ornamentation that I've been pointing out. And all that ornamentation, here's another element, and then another element here. This is really, this is 1915 to 22, with Frank Lloyd Wright really showing the result of his influence of Mayan architecture. I'm not going to lose it this time. And this is one of the first buildings that influenced him. This is the site of Chichen Itza, and it is the Temple of the Warriors, and it is in the Yucatan, on the Yucatan Peninsula. Has anybody been there beside myself? Oh, good, a couple of you. So here you have, look at the horizontal emphasis that he found so attractive, and then look at the sort of decorative elements here, and I'm going to show you a close-up of this post here, okay? So here we have a close-up. That's the post right inside the doorway at the top. It's an upside-down serpent post. You're going to see it more than once today, okay? But here is a serpent's tail. Okay. Here is the serpent's tail, and then it goes down the body. And this is the serpent's mouth, and this is the serpent's tongue, okay?
Did Frank Lloyd Wright ever visit these sites? Or
you're taking away my big thing in the lecture.
Sorry.
The answer is no, and I was going to get to it, okay? So I just want to show you. See this upside-down post right here? Right? It's one of the elements that's so, I mean, it means you're thinking, it's okay. He translated the pre-Hispanic motifs and abstracted them into this very new style of architecture that he was pioneering. And then, just to remind you, this is the back of the period of Uxmal. This is a drawing that was published in 1841. And then we'll look just quickly, because I know you all remember this. These are the plaster cast buildings at Chicago that were done for the World Fair that are all imitations of the site of Uxmal, okay? So we saw this one many times. There's the famous Uxmal Arch. And here is that kind of cookie-cutter facade that the Mayans were so famous for. You can see I deliberately chose this plaster cast version of it, because you can see how there's a rubble and core interior, and then the decorative elements are cut to fit perfectly and affixed to the rubble and core interior. Do you understand that? The reason I use the word cookie cutter is Frank Lloyd Wright begins to use that idea of replicating decorative motifs with like a cookie cutter, just mass producing them by hand and then using them on his buildings. So by the 1920s, he was developing these blocks, these decorative blocks that he was using on his buildings. After he worked in Japan, he then accepted a commission for a Los Angeles project, and this was 1920. The Los Angeles project, the woman who commissioned it is a woman named Aileen Barnsdall, B-A-R-N-S-D-A-L-L. She knew about Wright because she's a Chicago heiress, so she knew about him as the boy wunderkind in Chicago, right? And she was also a theatrical enthusiast. If anybody wants to read a really interesting biography, look up Aileen Barnsdale. But she bought a hilltop, an entire hilltop, in Los Angeles, and wanted Wright to design a residence, a theater space, artist apartments, and studios, etc. So the Barnsdale House was Wright's first full-scale project dependent on Mayan architecture. And what is so interesting is that Frank Lloyd Wright never went to Mexico and never visited these sites. So this is what you can do well if you do your research well. Okay? I want to show you this. You might, those of you who visit LA or know LA, might know this as the Barnsdale House. You might know it as Hollyhock House is another name for it. And it now belongs to the city and county of Los Angeles. There are gallery spaces here, there are performance spaces here, et cetera, and it's been saved. It's been renovated. So I want to show you, some. How many of you know this site at all? A few of you, okay. Gosh, I hope the e-reserves are okay because the slide labels that I have are incorrect. So somebody send me an email immediately when you go to the e-reserves that I don't know if this is, you know, it might be that this whole section was labeled incorrectly. Okay? I just noticed it, although I spent hours this weekend putting these in order. So here are the long shots of this house. This is okay, 1920. The hollyhock detail on the outside here, it was Aileen Barnsdale's favorite flower. And what this residence does, it's more than a house, covers this entire hillside, and there are little areas for outdoor theatrical performances. Sort of, you can sit on top and watch the performances down in these arena-type areas. Artist studio, she was very, very wealthy. If you want to know anything about the development of avant-garde theater and cinema in Los Angeles, you have to know about everybody who experimented at the Barnsdale House. It was sort of an icon of the cultural elite of the city of that time. So these are the restored shots of the Barnsdale House. This is during restoration. This is the view out across the Hollywood Hills. And this is one of his other inspirations for the way it was designed. This is called the Palace at Palenque, which is in the state of Chiapas, also enormously published all the time. And you can see that there, I hope you can see this, there are exterior... there are sort of an exterior wall around it, and then all of these little interior spaces for different kinds of activities. And that's sort of, and it's up on a raised, deliberately raised platform. So Frank Lloyd Wright, again, looked at this structure in drawings, and it helped him figure out how he would place the Barnsdale House on top of its hilltop in Los Angeles. So this is Palenque. And then there's some very interesting, almost one-to-one sort of appropriations and redesigns. This is the Barnsdale House. This is one of the small artist studios. built in 1920 and reconstructed in 1970, or renovated. And I just want to show you the exact building, also from Palenque. Okay? So this is the Temple of the Sun at Palenque, and I'll show you a close-up of it, and then I'll just quickly go back. So I hope you can understand that this is more streamlined, but it, again, is based really specifically on his sort of educated library work. The other kind of word you might find in describing this kind of architecture is streamlined modern, right? So there's Art Deco, streamlined modern, the prairie style. You know, there's just sort of a lot of different kinds of words that are used to describe it. Okay, the second house that he had, okay, let me catch up with this stuff, myself here. One especially sees the influence of the buildings at Palenque. The main ornamental motif of the house is the stylized hollyhock, her favorite flower. The courtyard, intended for theatrical performances, is reminiscent of the interior courts that the Mayans also used. They also used them for performances of a different nature, right? So his Los Angeles buildings are much less dramatic and flamboyant than the popular style, the Beaux-Arts style of Spanish architecture that you see all over California. So he really had a radical approach to architecture and immediately started gaining this absolutely sort of quintessential reputation. And it also, the movie industry became good patrons of his, because that's where the money was and still is in Los Angeles. And they liked the idea of somebody who was considered, you know, a pioneer, was looking at things differently, and would get a lot of press in the buildings. So this is the Charles Ennis House. Okay? He had four more residences that he did in Los Angeles, sort of 1923-24. You know, a huge, massive production all at once. I know this house quite well because I photographed it when I first lived in Los Angeles as this Google Gaga ex-New Yorker who could not believe the vistas and the architecture. I just would drive around with a camera all the time. And then it went into decay, and there was a huge movement in Los Angeles to save this house. And I recently was at the opening of the newly restored house. So it did get saved. It did get bought by the Los Angeles Conservancy. That's the name of the architectural organization, a very active architectural organization in Los Angeles. So this is 1923-24, the Charles Ennis House. It is across the hills from the Barnsdale House, also in the Hollywood Hills. You can see it here, set up in the hills with this incredible vista. And think of what this would be in the 1920s, without much development around it and without smog, etc. Unfortunately, this section right here collapsed about 10 years ago because of the rains, and then it's been rebuilt. But the house started fading away. It was really scary. And so this is near Griffith Park, near where the fire was recently in Los Angeles, for those of you who sort of know the city. So here we have, and this is what I'm going to talk about too. Do you see all of these rectangular or square motifs on the exterior of this house? This house and the three other ones become the textile block houses, is what their nickname became. Again, very influenced by the kind of decoration he saw in reproductions of architecture in the Yucatan. It's a use of a uniquely American. I always had trouble with that, because when people say American, they assume it's always the United States. But, you know, there are a lot of countries in North and South America. So I just want to tell you that I have trouble with it, but that's what everybody calls it. Okay, so it's a uniquely American source of aesthetic inspiration. It's negating the European Beaux-Arts influence completely in this pioneering kind of style of architecture. He wanted to make efficient architecture. He wanted to make economically achievable buildings, but of course his patrons were madly wealthy at this point. And he wanted to use inexpensive materials to build, and this is important, well-designed houses. Okay? So he created these textile blocks that, like cookie cutters that could be set out, right, and then used on the facade of these houses. So the whole group of houses that I'm talking about now, again, they are cast concrete slabs were joined together by steel joints. Okay? So it's cast concrete that you're looking at. And he, I'll show you how he sited it. This is my own shot from the road, right? This is the name of the street, right? The road, and this is how you see it as you pass by it on the road. So there's this magnificent facade, and it looks like, you know, a Mayan temple. When you're driving, it's got, you know, there's fortification, there's the textile blocks that are there, all the ingredients are there. And here's the front gate. Some of you might know this, but Frank Lloyd Wright was rather a control freak. Very gifted man, but many very gifted people are also very difficult people. And he designed all the furniture, all the textiles, all the ironwork, all the stained glass windows, all the lighting fixtures, etc., etc. And if you're ever in New York City, go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, because they have one whole prairie-style room of completely a Frank Lloyd Wright room. So you can see everything that he does, you know. So this is just my sort of sneaking up to the gate so that you could see the original gate that he designed for the house. Here's another one as you're walking around the exterior. And then I do have magazine reproduction of the interior. So this is a typical kind of Frank Lloyd Wright stained glass window, but you can see it's very modern. It's very abstract. It certainly doesn't look like a church in Europe. And here's the interior of these blocks that he uses. This is the dining room, obviously, with a view. And this is down a hallway, and you see it of the same house, so you can see the concrete blocks continually, you know, continue down the hallway of the house. And here is just a close-up of the kind of the cookie-cutter concrete blocks that I've been discussing. So they're mass-produced out of concrete. They did not hold up well to rain. It's been a huge problem in restoring his structures because concrete is not, you know, that sturdy a material, right? It can be devastated fairly easily by nature. But he wanted he was experimenting in sort of the economics of good architecture here. So he wanted a material that was also low cost. Again, this is just the exterior. And then I'll just show you what he was inspired by. This is all Uxmal. So if you look at the top section here, right, it's all that kind of mosaic pattern in stone. Here's a close-up of the top section. So you can see that he was very inspired by the way the Mayans used these kind of mass-produced, but this is stone, mass-produced by human hands here. And it fit perfectly, too. There you go. This part was copied in Chicago. You've seen this serpent part before. But look at the design in the background here. See it? And then there's one other site. And one of the reasons these are called textile block houses also is that in pre-Hispanic architecture, it has been, I think most people agree at this point, that each one of these patterns has a meaning for the Native Americans, that they probably refer to textile patterns that you were only allowed to wear if you were part of the aristocracy. So that although they are abstract to our eyes and not symbolic, most authorities agree now that these were based on textile patterns and the weavers were commissioned by the elite of each of these sites. Yes?
Now, in the original sites, these are made of solid stone.
Cut stone.
And then the relief is cut into it?
Oh, no, it's stone blocks that are then faced together.
Okay.
Onto the rubble and core interior.
Okay.
So it's mass produced by human hands. That's what I meant. They fit in perfectly. It's, you know, if you think about it, it's a magnificent kind of architectural form. And so this is why his houses are, these are called textile block houses for Frank Lloyd Wright also. And this is a site called Mitla, but I think it's one of the best sites to help you understand what he was looking at. Mitla, Central Mexico. And then there's the Millard House in Pasadena. So this is the Millard House in Pasadena. These are all my own photographs. This is the Millard House in Pasadena. Also, all of this is 1923-24, basically. And there you can see the blocks on the exterior. A long shot of it. And there's a typical Frank Lloyd Wright interior. This is the Millard House interior. So just about everything you're looking at, except probably the Bauer vase, that cobalt blue vase, was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. That's typical mission style furniture also. If your grandparents own that furniture and it's labeled, they've got a fortune. It was imitated in the bungalows all over. You know this furniture from your house?
Oh, I have.
You have it.
Well, not frankly, right, but the style.
The style, yeah. So that's sort of, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright. Remember, this is the second part of the course, so this is cultures in fusion, right, rather than cultures in collision. And I think that this, at least those buildings, really demonstrate how he's been able to sort of fuse influences in his architecture. Yeah?
Do you know how long is that style on the West Coast? Because I'm from Indiana and I never really remember seeing...
No, that the textile blocks houses are all on the West Coast. The Midwest stuff that he did is known as the prairie style, and it's those long, horizontal... houses.
That was earlier?
Yeah.
What year was the Millard
House? All this is 23-24. Okay. Same as Barnsdale. It was this huge... They were... The patrons sort of competed with it, each other, to see who could get the better Frank Lloyd Wright house at this period.
Mm-hmm.
And it, there. Can you see it from the exterior?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, see? Something local that I didn't know about.
Yeah, I was walking by and the owners were like in the process of redoing, like having them, I don't know, what, refurbished, trying to sort of fixing them. But yeah, they're all done by him.
That's great. Thank you. I would like that. Make a little list of local things. When
There's also a house in Oakland that was redone.
I don't think there's a Frank Lloyd Wright house.
It's not the original, but there's like three houses in a row that they redid, like each house was like exact reproduction from the blueprints.
Of a Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah.
Oh, because I kind of know Oakland architecture.
Yeah, in the hills when it burned down, there's one of my aunt lives in Oakland, but there's three houses on that block, all they rebuilt.
They rebuilt it according to original blueprints?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Tell me the block. I'd like to
get
me the address.
Yeah,
great.
Totally.
I did a, you'll see why in this next lecture, but when I taught at Cal State Northridge many, many years ago, when I was doing my PhD, my MA at UCLA, I did an exhibition with the students there. It was a little more liberal, the way the program was organized. And I sent the entire class out to the greater Los Angeles area, and each person was responsible in finding a Maya Revival style building. and to photograph it and to give the address. And then we did an exhibition of these photographs and the addresses and everything. Some of it is in this lecture now. But it's easier to do this in L.A. than it is up here, the Maya style, especially when it's sort of non-named architects. But I have a couple things coming up I think you'll be interested in. But I would appreciate any extra addresses or information. So we're dealing with this whole idea of the Maya revival style in the United States, especially in terms of architecture. But I'm also going to talk right now a little bit about theater and dance, because it all is part of the same package of modernism. I showed you some buildings at the very beginning of my lecture, and I'm going to show you a little bit more now. But this Maya streamline style, Maya revival style, there's just all sorts of names that are associated with it. And I want you to know about this fabulous dance troupe that we're going to start with. So this is Ruth St. Denis and Ted Shawn. And it is also Los Angeles. Don't listen to anybody when they tell you that Los Angeles is culturally vacant. It's not true at all. It never has been true, okay? Ted Shawn was a very famous Los Angeles-based dancer who formed his own dance company. And he premiered in 1920, so we got the same dates here. A Mexican Mayans inspired ballet. I don't know how else to call it, because they were not scholars, so they just sort of used generic words to talk about this. And this troupe, this is Ted Shawn and Ruth St. Denis, they then formed a troupe together, and the name of that dance troupe is Denis Shawn. And is it in your study guide?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Just Denis Shawn, not their name.
Oh, okay. So we're now, right, on page 16. So Denis Shawn is the official name of this dance company. And so I just wanted you to see this. This is their Balinese phase, 1924. They're dressed up in sort of Balinese-inspired costumes. And here is Ted Shawn. Ted Shawn was just an exotic, erotic, brilliant dancer, costume designer, choreographer. Here he is, and it's called Invocation to the Thunderbird. Okay? So he was reading a lot of Native American and Mexican mythology when he was working on these dances, this choreography, and these costumes. Here's a spectacular one. This is a Mexican pre-Hispanic emperor. Again, it's all in his own personal fantasy, but it's based on textual material. So here he is in his costume for a ballet he did in 1923. So it's the same dates as the Barnsdale House, the same kind of money was going into these productions that would be hiring Frank Lloyd Wright. It was a whole kind of aesthetic movement, cultural movement in the greater Los Angeles area. So this is 1923. Here he is in the Eagle Dance of a year later. So he's looking at sort of indigenous American sources, just like Frank Lloyd Wright looked at indigenous American sources. So this is the counterpart in the performing arts. Here you see the Eagle Dance, the set for the finale of the Eagle Dance, and I just want to show you see these three figures right here? Now, you could never do this today. I mean, this is a particular moment in time. Please don't think that I'm teaching you this to inspire you to do the same thing today, because what you're looking at here are very sacred Native American masquerades that he replicated on the stage. And those three figures there, here you see it in drawing, are Zuni Pueblo Chalico figures. So the other thing I think I'm trying to underscore here is the amount of research that all of these people did. in terms of, you know, of their designs, their aesthetic acts. So we have, here we have Ruth St. Denis and Angkor Wat. If you remember the French colonial exposition that I taught you, that was in Paris, where they reproduced the entire site of Angkor Wat. So here we have the North American equivalent of that. Do you remember that? And then I showed you the bullet holes in the building from
Cambodia
from the war. I know I showed you that. But anyway, I didn't?
You did.
Yeah, I did. Good. Okay. So it's the same site. 1930. I think a colonial exposition in Paris I taught you was 1931. So again, dealing with the same dates here. Yeah.
Is it just sheer coincidence that her name is like a street in Paris? Rue Saint-Denis is like in Montmartre?
Yeah, I know. When you said it, I said, light bulb goes off, you know, Howard Hawks inside my head. I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't even know if that's her birth name. You probably can find it, but it is a nice coincidence.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay. Here she is in that same ballet with the Chalico dancers. Here she is as a Native American dancer. So we have, and here's 1923, the same ballet. So we have in the performing arts sort of the equal to what Frank Lloyd Wright was doing in the architectural arts. And the same people in Los Angeles, the same cultural group, are the patrons of this environment of the 20s and 30s in Los Angeles. And out of that environment, and this then becomes known as the Maya Revival style. So by the end of the 1920s, it has an official name that you can look up in art history textbooks and history of American art books. And out of that sort of movement, one particular man in Southern California sort of, it becomes famous. And you're looking at him here. Here is a publicity photo. He is an architect. His name is Robert Stacy Judd. Okay? So he's an architect from the Los Angeles area. This is one of his publicity photos. Here's another one, so you get a kind of feeling what he was like. This is the architect Robert Stacy Judd. And does anybody, I don't know where you're from. Anybody from the Los Angeles area know this building? You know it.
I don't know it.
You don't know it, but you've seen it?
Yeah.
Anybody else from down there seen this? This is in a town east of Los Angeles in the foothills. It's called Monrovia, California. And this is the Aztec Hotel in Monrovia, California, that Robert Stacy Judd designed. It actually still stands. It's a monument. It's on all architectural tours. He did it in 1925. So there's my long shot of it. And then I have some shots from books. I'll show it to you. Here's a close-up of what it looked like in its early stages on the board. And you can see that it's much more decorative and flamboyant than Frank Lloyd Wright, as were the Dennis Shawn dance troupe, so that there's this sort of modernist element that Frank Lloyd Wright does and this sort of decorative, flamboyant element that other people do. But it's all a package called the Maya Revival style. And so here's the design of it. Here's a bad slide of it. And then you go to the inside. And I have to go back because and get my own photographs. I just haven't had enough time of the inside. So the inside of this is the main lobby of the Aztec Hotel in Monrovia. And here you have the mural in a quasi sort of Mayan motif of in that main library. Lobby. And here you have this, I don't know how you feel about this building, but when I first saw it, I couldn't believe it. This is Robert Stacy Judd in Ventura, California, and this is the First Baptist Church. Look at it. I mean, this is staggering. It was done 1928, 1930. And there's your Uxmal Arch, you know, the one thing that comes up over and over and over again in this architectural style is the Uxmal Arch. So this is Stacy Judd's And then I have some, didn't change? Oh, a close-up of it, okay. And then I have buildings that I don't know who designed them, but this style then transferred into the vernacular. So you have lots of buildings and lots of hotels and lots of apartment buildings that were built in this period. This is a Masonic temple on Tahunga Boulevard that I found, but I was looking for Uxmal arches all over L.A. So here you have this in a vernacular style, really. There's the side of it. Do you see that they are also using the textile block element as decorative element here? I'm going to skip this. There's the Uxmal itself, close up of the arch. And then we have, this is the corner of Glendale and Glen Oaks Boulevards out in the San Fernando Valley. So this is the Aztec House apartment building. I have no idea if it's still there. I shot these in 1973, but I want to show you something else. This is real. Look closely, because this is a Mayan chacmool right here in front of the Aztec House. And for those of you who've never seen a Mayan chacmool, it's based on it's a recumbent warrior, and it was originally in Mayan culture, he held a bowl in his hands right here, and that is where intestines and hearts of victims were placed. So he was used as a sort of sacrificial altar. So this is at Chichen Itza. This is the chacmool from Chichen Itza. And then there's one, this one right here, which is underneath a great temple in Chichen Itza. So this is, again, it's book learning. It's people looking at picture books. That was part of this fad, this craze that was sweeping across the United States. Yeah.
How do you spell chacmool?
C-H-A-C-M-O-O-L. And then I want to know how many people know this building.
That's it's a movie theater, but it's down in the valley.
It's what?
I know it's in this valley.
No, it's downtown LA. It's right in the heart of downtown Los Angeles. And it was a very important designer who designed the exterior. His name, I hope it's in your study guide, Francisco Cornejo. Yeah, there it is. Francisco Cornejo, who, anyway, if anybody wanted to do an MA thesis, this is an MA thesis screaming to be done, this stuff. But he was a costume designer and a theater designer, and then he worked for different architects. And I'm showing you the long shot on purpose, because in the years that I lived in Los Angeles and shot this, it was a pornographic movie house. It then became a nightclub, okay? But it is, he designed it. It's called the Mayan Theater. It's in the heart of downtown Los Angeles, and it was 1927. And I'll just keep getting closer and closer to it. And here's the Mayan Theater. Here's the Mayan motifs. The exterior was repainted in the 1960s with household paint. It was a group of young people who decided they really were going to try to save this building, and all they could afford was household paint. And they looked at a National Geographic, and it is true. They wished they hadn't used household paint, but it is true that in Mayan architecture, everything was originally very brightly colored, just like we know now from Greek sculpture and architecture. That, you know, we think of it as this great white classical style. Totally incorrect, right? Totally, completely incorrect. It was very, very brightly painted. So they looked at this. So here we have, and again, it's the same thing we've been looking at. When I'm, you know, this really was a fad. There's books out on movie theaters across the United States that were done in this style. It really was a complete Americanist, very aggressively Americanist look to America for your inspiration. Do not look to Europe. And I'll remind you of something. We're now, you know, sort of 1927 and 1930s, and by 1933 we have the rumblings of fascism in Europe, right, that you've already studied. So part of the impetus for all of this was, you know, be American, don't look to Europe for your inspiration and for your sources. It was also an anti-cultural elite kind of movement. It was a bit, but the word that's usually used is a vernacular movement, that they didn't, the people who did this, this was popular arts and popular architecture for the American citizen, especially the movie theaters. And you're going into the Depression, and I guess most of you know that the movies that were made and the movie theaters that were made famous during the Depression were highly, highly organic and spectacular. The whole idea was to take your mind off the fact that you were losing all your money, right? Busby Berkeley choreography, if some of you are movie buffs. Okay, so here we have the Mayan Theater in Los Angeles, and here is a detail of the wall, which is based on Mayan glyph writing. So here's the Mayan Theater, and here is a Mayan glyph ensemble from Palenque, just so you can make the association yourselves. And here's the interior. Remember Frank Lloyd Wright's Upside Down Serpent, where I said you're going to see it again? So here it is here, and you know, this is the serpent head and going up to the tail up here. And then quickly to remind you, this is the foyer, the interior foyer of the Mayan Theater. And quickly to remind you, there's the Temple of the Warriors that had this at the very top. Okay? So it's the same building exactly that is used. And, oh, yeah, and then we have the interior. And so this is a gaudily painted statue, sort of slightly two-dimensional statue on, and I'll show you, I just can't do this right. Here's the face, okay? There's the face, and he's wearing his headdress, and he's completely in costume. And this is actually based on, again, an actual, it's based on a drawing of a stela with a human figure from the Mayan site of Tikal. So Francisco Cornejo is the man that did this sort of decorative work and then studied the Mayan architecture and used it in the building. So the last building is this one.
Can I ask a quick question?
You can ask any questions you want.
Cornejo?
Yeah.
It says in the study guide that he designed the costumes for the dance company. Did he design them, or did the...
I think it was collaborative.
Okay.
I mean, he worked with Dennis Shawn, I know that.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you. Who knows what this is?
Cornejo?
Boy, did I not get the timing. You don't mind if I'm happy to go home. Somebody just said it. Yep, Sutter Street, downtown San Francisco. Please go see this building. This is 1930, 450 Sutter Street. Okay? It is a medical building.
My dentist is there.
What? Your dentist is there.
My dentist and my
But you didn't recognize the exterior?
There's no gold door. It's a white
private. Okay, I'm going to go. Really, this is a absolutely magnificent building in downtown San Francisco, designed by Timothy Pfluger. His name should be.
Yes, sir.
It's there. Okay. And this is, they built a skyscraper at 450 Sutter Street. The Mayan style is in the ornate lobby, and the upper story suite, which I have not been to yet, I still want to go, has Mayan-inspired murals. But look at this. This is the exterior from across the street. And then here is looking up the facade of the building that I shot from across the street. Okay. Then you walk into the building, and where the elevators are downstairs is all this gold, this fake gold, with all of these sort of pre-Hispanic motifs on it. And here's above the elevators, the entire lobby. It surrounds you with pre-Hispanic motifs. It's a fairly spectacular, it's a very famous building also. It's in all the architecture books. You've been?
I
Some of you have been, maybe now that you remember what you've paid. Now you know the context in which it was done. Okay? And so do you see the open mouth right here? Do you see that? The open mouth of the serpent? There you go. Chichen Itza in the Yucatan. There's the open mouth of the serpent. So that's it. I really badly timed this one, but it doesn't matter. You're probably happy to go home. Wait, somebody has a question. I can't answer that. I don't know. I'd have to check it. I don't know if City College was first built in the 1930s. So I'm sorry about this, but we're going to do Elizabeth Catlett, and I assure you that lecture will take the whole period. We're going to do that on Thursday.
My boyfriend's grandmother lives in Nairobi, and I pass by the hotel all the time.
So go inside and shoot the inside for me in
digital. I was just about to offer that.
Okay, because I don't even own a digital camera. That would be great. Thank you.
I drive by it all the time when I visit her, so... Thank
it's
you.
A fabulous. I've seen the outside.
Yeah. Well, I'll shoot the inside for
Thank
you.
Thank you. Did you win an award?